Det er en søndag med nedbør de fleste steder i landet, i de østlige egne stadig som slud eller sne, mens regn breder sig fra vest. Selvom frostværet er over med temperaturer mellem 1 og 4 plusgrader, så advarer Vejdirektoratet om glatte veje på grund af snemasserne. Jeg er tilbage med flere nyheder kl. 14.
Velkommen til aflyttet, programmet der iført skæg og blå briller, i hvert fald indeni, hvordan det så end ser ud. Det har jeg stadigvæk ikke fundet ud af, for at finde ud af mere omkring, hvordan sådan noget kan se ud, så er jeg taget en tur til udlandet, jeg er taget til Belgien, til Bruxelles, hvor jeg lige nu befinder mig til en konference, der hedder Computers Privacy og Data Protection, Reloading Data Protection, altså vi lader igen omkring databeskyttelse. Den her konference, det her Computers Privacy and Data Protection, det forkortes populært simpelthen CPDP, og det vil sige, at den her konference, den hedder bare CPDP 2013. Det er den 6. årlige af de her konferencer, hvor regeringsfolk fra hele verden, og især EU-folk, mødes med blandt andet folk fra privacy-bevægelser rundt omkring i Europa, og med industrien, som selvfølgelig også er hernede for at forsøge at få dem til at forstå, hvordan de gerne vil have, at tingene skal hænge sammen. De tre store emner for den her konference, som har fundet sted i år, som finder sted over 3 dage, det er først databeskyttelse, som der har været en hel dag om, og i dag handler det så om det, der hedder cloud computing, eller det der med skyerne, som er noget, som der bliver diskuteret meget hernede. Det vil netop sige sådan, kan man have en europæisk sky, for eksempel? Kan man overhovedet, findes det overhovedet? Er det muligt? Og ligesom at sige, at den her sky ligger altså i Europa med de her data, og derfor så gælder der europæiske regler for den. Det er et af de emner, som kommer op omkring det. Og så har der været et tredje meget stort emne, det er det, man kalder big data. Store datamængder, som er sådan noget, man forsker i og prøver på at diskutere meget nu, hvem der har lov til at udnytte dem. Altså det er et klassisk eksempel, det er sådan nogle som Facebook og Google, som jo roder med den slags, og bruger det til at finde oplysninger om folk, som de kan, ikke om folk, men om befolkningsgrupper, som de så bagefter kan sælge til forskellige firmaer og bruge det til at sende nogle forskellige produkter med. Både big data og sky computing, det er noget, som vi kommer til at tale mere om i et andet program. Det her, det kommer primært til at handle om databeskyttelse af enhver art. Aflyttet kommer til at lyde lidt anderledes i dag, end det plejer, og det hænger sammen med, for det første, jeg optager på en lidt anden båndoptager, men det hænger også sammen med, at jeg også optager nogle forskellige steder. Lige nu står jeg på mit hotelværelse, og det lyder lidt anderledes end selve den her konference, som jeg egentlig også er på. Selve konferencen, den er jo ganske... Den består jo af en frygtelig masse mennesker, som stiller sig op og taler og holder nogle lange oplæg, hvor de fortæller om ting, som de går op i, såkaldte sessions, og dem er der rigtig mange af på sådan en konference som den her. Vi kan ikke bringe dem alle sammen for at sige det mildt, derfor så har jeg tilladt mig at klippe lidt af det sammen, så I kan høre, hvordan sådan noget det kan lyde.
If you look at the text now, it says the decision, the self-assessment about appropriate safeguards, must be made by duly authorized staff. These transfers must be documented, and the documentation must be made available to the supervisory authority on request.
Transparency, the importance of due process and accountability. And I'm afraid, from where I stand, aware that there are differing views on this.
Must be made by duly authorized staff.
Transparency.
I do agree, however, that there is a big importance in amending existing agreements.
Even now, there are unaccountable processes in action.
On the basis of existing agreements at national level, which often have very weak data protection provisions, if any.
Transparency.
But even more, what I have discovered during my own experience is that often these kind of exchanges simply take place on the basis of reciprocity.
One only has to look at the extradition arrangements.
Basis of reciprocity. Give information to each other. If you give me this, I give you that. Basis of reciprocity.
Transparency.
Must be made by duly authorized staff.
Basis of reciprocity.
My name is Andreas Krisch. I'm president of European Digital Rights, which is the umbrella organization of 30 data protection and human rights organizations from more than 20 countries in Europe. We define Europe as the countries of the Council of Europe, so it's not only the European Union, but the broader area, geographic area. And one of our main focuses, of course, currently is the data protection reform, and so this is one of the main conferences where the reform package is discussed.
Andreas Krich er en af lederne i den europæiske borgerretsorganisation Digital Rights. Organisationen har afdelinger over hele Europa, der har simpelthen også været en i Danmark, men nu satses der på de store fælles europæiske løsninger. Det er der nemlig god mening i, mener Andreas Krich, der håber, at datatilsyn fra Europa får mere magt og mulighed for sanktioner, hvis reglerne bliver overtrådt.
I think from a citizen's perspective, the most important thing is that we manage to get real enforcement of data protection rules. What we have now with the existing directive is that the rules are not that bad, but the enforcement is a real problem. So data protection authorities are very weak. The possibilities for data subjects to exercise their rights are not developed enough, and so we need huge reform on that and need to find ways on how to improve. So we need stronger data protection authorities, but we also need ways to empower citizens to exercise their rights and so on. So I think that's one of the main points that needs to be achieved. And therefore I think that the current approach that there is proposed a regulation instead of a directive is a good way forward, because then we will have one set of rules for all over Europe that does not need to be interpreted by the member states and transferred to national law, but it's immediately binding as a European regulation. So we have a real harmonization across the European Union, and if I go to other member states, I can be sure that I have enjoyed the same data protection and privacy rights there as I do at home, and this is a great achievement for us.
De samme regler skal gælde over hele Europa, mener altså Andreas Krich. Det skal være sådan, at min databeskyttelse gælder i hele EU, og et af de områder, som Digital Rights har særligt i kiggerne, er de to giganter, Google og Facebook, og deres registrering og datamining af brugerne. Står det til EU og Digital Rights, skal man have lov til at nægte at lade Google og Facebook gemme data omkring os, og noget Facebook allerede har reageret meget vredt på, man skal have lov til at gemme sig og bruge pseudonymer på Facebook.
One important point, especially regarding international companies like Google, Facebook, etc., that is proposed is that they not only are obliged to comply with European law when they are established in the European Union, but also when they target the European market. So if they have services that target on European citizens, then they are obliged to be compliant with the European Data Protection Regulation. And this is a great advantage, because then immediately, whatever they do elsewhere, they have to comply as they do their businesses here in the European Union. And for that, that's improvement, of course, that hopefully will survive the legislative process.
One of the buzzwords which has been around here is the right to be forgotten. Well, could you explain what does that mean?
Well, it's a stronger focus on the already existing right to deletion of data. So actually now you already have the right that data that is not necessary or that is not correct must be deleted by the data processors. And this is reinforced now because you can demand that data that you maybe put on Facebook or somewhere else is taken off the platform, that you can take it away from them and go to another service and insert it there because you like this other service more and such features. So it's an enhanced version of the already existing right to deletion.
There's also been a discussion of one thing that is very specific about Facebook is that they are insisting on that you give up your correct identity. They want it all. There's been talk about that some of this EU legislation should make it possible to actually go in via a pseudonym, and that should be legal. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think it's important to have the possibility to use pseudonyms because not everything that we do, we want to do it with our real name. That's not a question of doing something wrong or doing something hiddenly, but it's a measure of protection of one's identity and of one's privacy because we do not want everything to be known by everybody, and therefore it's sometimes necessary to do things under a pseudonym or another name that one just makes up. And this is an important feature because then it's more difficult for people that to aggregate data and to analyze it, to profiling on data, to connect the dots. And especially when we think about health concerns, for example, if I need information on what a certain disease has for consequences, maybe I do not want this to be tracked back to me and to be attributed to my real identity. And I may want to first get information in an anonymous way. And so that's what the feature is for. And therefore, I think it's important to have the possibility.
So you're actually also working on defending the right to be anonymous on the internet.
Yes, of course, certainly. It's one of the most important things because you need tools to keep in control of your data. To say, okay, to whom do I want to give which information? And if this possibility is gone and if you always need to prove who you are, then all the others with whom you do business or whose services you use know all the information that you have to submit to access the services, but they collect it. And so they got huge data profiles on your person. And therefore you need means to manage that a bit and to have different identities, so to say, at different services, so that it's more difficult to connect the profiles from various services, for example.
Retten til at blive glemt er yderst central i de nye EU-databeskyttelsesregler, der altså forventes at træde i kraft om et års tid. Men en ting er alle de fine ord om store og ordentlige firmaer fra USA. Men hvad med EU selv? EU står som bekendt bag logningsbekendtgørelsen, den der betyder, at teleselskaberne gemmer, hvem du ringer til, hvem der ringer til dig, oplysninger om sms og e-mail-trafik og hvilke sider du besøger på internettet. Oplysninger, der alle sammen skal bruges af politiet, hvis de bagefter får lyst til at gå i gang med en opklaring. Hvordan går det her egentlig op med alle de gode intentioner?
It's a good question. It's already now a good question if it is completely legal. We work on the data retention directive since it was negotiated in the Parliament, in Council and the Commission. And we challenged the national laws in several member states who were involved in court proceedings. I myself filed a with 11,000 others filed a constitutional complaint in Austria. Which now was referred from our constitutional court to the European Court of Justice. So there are now two court cases at the European Court of Justice because also an Irish case has been referred there. And the court will have to decide if the data retention directive as it stands is compliant with the fundamental rights to data protection and the fundamental rights to privacy and family life. Because there are, of course, severe concerns and everywhere where data retention has been challenged in courts, like in Germany, for example, the national implementations have been abolished. And in Romania, for example, the court even decided that data retention is violating human rights. So in Romania, currently, there is no possibility to introduce such a law again. And which, of course, creates for them a problem that they cannot comply with their obligation to implement the directive. And And so we will see what the court decides. And I'm convinced there is a violation with data protection fundamental rights, and therefore it has to be abolished.
I Tyskland og i Rumænien har de ikke indført nogen logningsbekendtgørelse. Begge steder mener man, at det strider mod forfatningen, og det sågar er en overtrædelse af de europæiske menneskerettighedskonventions styk 8 om retten til privatliv. Digital Rights fører i øjeblikket en sag ved EU-domstolen for at erklære logningen ugyldig. Udgangspunktet for den kamp er Østrig, hvor man ikke var meget for at indføre logningsbekendtgørelsen, da man mente, den var forfatningsstridig. Østrig blev truet med bøder, og så var man nødt til at indføre den, og så slog Digital Rights til.
Yeah. Well, Austria was very late with implementing the directive. We had one attempt in 2007, but this failed because there were lots of protests, and even the parts of the governmental services, the constitutional that deal with constitutional affairs, said that it was not possible to do it in this way. And so Austria took some more time. And in 2009, then we had infringement procedures from the Commission. So we faced fines if we do not implement it, and then the Austrian government asked a human rights NGO to draft the law, and they tried to do it as data protection friendly as possible, but they concluded that it simply is not possible to do it compliant with data protection laws, but the law was introduced to avoid the fines from the Commission. And then we started, as soon as it went into force, a mass complaint at the Constitutional Court, which means we collected 11,139 people that complained at the Constitutional Court together with us against this national implementation. And the Constitutional Court now decided in December to refer the case to the European Court to decide whether the directive as such is compliant with the fundamental rights charter.
So they, what you're complaining about is that it's it goes against your right of privacy in piece 8 of the Human Rights Convention.
Exactly, yeah. And it's the European Convention on Human Rights, but also the Charter on Fundamental Rights of the European Union. And this is a new fundamental rights package that was not in place when the directive was implemented or was legislated. So the question is, did the human and fundamental rights area change so significantly that it is not longer possible to keep this directive? Because now there are strict rules, even in primary law of the European Union, that say that people have the fundamental right to the protection of their data and their privacy.
Sagen er altså på vej igennem en EU-domstol, og Andreas Krieg regner med, at det kommer til at tage et års tid. Hvis de vinder, så skal samtlige lande trække deres logningsbekendtgørelser tilbage. Men derfor er det jo ikke sikkert, at der ikke bliver registreret noget. Flere teleselskaber registrerer i forvejen af forretningsmæssige hensyn, og medmindre de ikke kan argumentere for, hvorfor, så vil de registre stadigvæk være åbne for politi og efterretningsvæsen, når en sag skal undersøges. Hovedproblemet er, at alle tydeligvis regnes for skyldige, til det modsatte er bevist.
It would fall and will be taken away, and most probably when the directive is taken away, then the national implementations cannot remain and will be abolished as well. And I think it's a broadly excessive piece of legislation. So it is I do not know a single case where it proved to be necessary for law enforcement agencies to have such data, because there is always a way to get to the information, and we are talking about to keep the data long. So the directive says it's the data needs to be kept longer than the service providers use it for billing purposes, for example. So when the directive is abolished, still the data remains for the period of time where the service providers, telecoms and so on, need the data. And of course, police can then can then have access to this data because it's there, and so they will have the mechanisms to access it. And the question is, simply is it allowed according to fundamental rights to store data that is not needed for any purposes, just for the case that maybe you could commit a crime.
På en konference, hvor det flyder med fine ord som datasikkerhed, gennemsigtighed og privacy, så er der noget ekstremt selvmodsigende i, at ret få diskuterer staternes egen overvågning af egne befolkninger. Det er fordi, det ikke er de samme mennesker, der beskæftiger sig med det, siger Andreas Krich, der desværre ser langt strammere love på vej i fremtiden. Stærke kræfter i EU ønsker for eksempel at udvide logningen med generel registrering af al transport, herunder fly og tog. Data, der skal kunne overføres til USA og imellem medlemslande.
There is no assumption of innocence anymore, because everybody is then some kind of suspicious that maybe he or she is violating the law. And there are data collections for no purposes, which is a no-go with data protection, because the very principle of data protection is that it has to be necessary for a specific purpose. And the specific purpose is not just law enforcement, but it needs to be an investigation in a specific case. Then it is permissible, of course.
But it's very interesting because down here on the floor, everybody's talking about data protection and everything else, but nobody's talking about that the same institution is also forcing their own. They don't have any data protection for their own people, and the states are surveilling their own people and not considering them innocent. Yeah. Do you think that discussion would it come here?
Well, in part it are different people, that the ones that are talking about data protection and the others that are talking about surveillance. And they even go further. They now try to introduce a new directive on passenger name records. This is the data that is collected when you use an airplane. Then they want to introduce a regime that all of this data on who you are, which connections you have flown, how frequent you fly, and so on, which food you prefer on the plane, which hotels you book, which cars you book, all such information shall be stored on, retained without any purpose for law enforcement purposes. And they also want to transfer this data to the US, for example, but also want to do it within Europe, where they want to monitor who is going where and which travel movements you have. And only recently, 2 days ago, I think it was mentioned that also the train connections should be stored for the, especially mentioned was the connection from London to Paris, so the tunnel in the channel. So we are facing a development that goes in the direction that all of our movements and of our communication is monitored. And I think personally that this is a very dangerous thing to do, because this goes to the core of our democracies. And because if I'm in a situation where I'm not able to communicate freely without having the feeling that I'm monitored, where I'm not able to move freely without having the feeling that I'm monitored, then I might not do the same things that I would have done. And I would have problems probably with finding political decisions, for example. I need to talk to people to find my own positions and to discuss certain topics that are important in a democracy. And I need to do this in a private atmosphere. And I need to be able to talk to political parties and to go there. I need to be able to talk to the union if I have a problem in my labor work. And so these are important things where privacy and data protection is very important, where it's very important that you can do things freely without being monitored. And this is taken away. And this is a very, very dangerous thing to do in a democracy, because this gives all the power to the state and to the ones that are in power. And then there is no balance anymore. And we are having an imbalance of power then, that is very dangerous.
Alligevel mener Andreas og Digital Rights, at EU trods alt er et bedre sted at forhandle den slags. Og kommer forbrugerbeskyttelsen i hus som lov, ja, så kan det være, at de statslige tiltag følger med.
Yes, but on the other hand, this broad and large body of the European Union also gives some stability to the whole system. Because some member states tend to be to return a little bit to having less freedom for the citizens to give more power to the government and so on. So these tendencies are also a little bit hindered it's not so easy to do such things. So there are also benefits from this. And if we manage to get a good data protection regime, then I think this is a huge step forward. If we really manage to fix the things that are now open, we have a year now to discuss all of this framework. But if it's finally achieved, I think there will be huge benefits to all citizens in the European Union.
Når man sådan går og hører på folk, der taler engelsk hele tiden, så bliver man jo helt glad, når man møder nogen, der taler dansk. En af dem, det var Troels Ørting Jørgensen, som jeg kom til at høre et oplæg fra. Han har faktisk tidligere været chef for blandt andet politiets efterretningstjeneste, og nu kommer han til at stå i spidsen for det her nyåbnede center for Europol, som er deres cybercrime unit. Han har 30 folk under sig, og de skal bekæmpe internetkriminalitet i hele EU. Troels Ørting Jørgensen er en af de mennesker, som er meget ked af, hvis man skal have lov til at være anonym på det her internet. I hvert fald skal man have mulighed for at finde ud af, hvor folk er, fordi hvis man ikke ved, hvem de er, så er det yderst vanskeligt at fange eventuelle forbrydere. Men det, jeg var interesseret i at høre med dig, det var, at du er den første, som jeg har hørt hernede, der sådan fuldstændig for alvor siger, at det der anonymitet, det kan folk godt droppe, når det er på internettet. Så kommer vi simpelthen ikke nogen vejen. Ja. Kan du bare fortælle mig lidt om, hvorfor altså, det her med anonymitet, det var sådan en gammel, hævdvunden internetret, men den mener du, den er ved at løbe ud nu?
Jamen, der sker jo det, at vi laver mere og mere på internettet, og det vil så sige, at hele vores liv er der. Du har formentlig alle dine e-mails og dine billeder, dine børn og dine bankforretninger, du låner bøger, du laver selvangivelser og alt muligt andet, og det bliver mere og mere. Og derfor er vi nødt til at beskytte det. Så den der gamle teori om, at man kan sådan sidde med langt hår og guitar, og så tro, at man bare kan have en ret til at blive glemt, den tror jeg ikke holder længere, fordi samfundet er simpelthen nødt til at beskytte dine informationer, dine penge og alle mulige. Og på den måde er vi nødt til at have nogle informationer om, hvem der agerer på internettet.
Hvordan tror du, hvordan skal man få det?
Ja, det er jo et enormt vanskeligt spørgsmål, fordi nogen taler om vi skal have en identitet, andre taler om, at man skal lave aftaler med ICANN, som laver det her administration af internettet, således som man kan se, hvem der er bag ved en IP-adresse. Men i fremtiden vil der jo også være mange, der anonymiserer deres IP-adresse og ser ud, som om de kommer et andet sted fra. Og det betyder så, at politiet formentlig skal have andre redskaber for at kunne følge det her. Og det i sig selv er en stor udfordring.
Hvordan er det arbejde, du sidder med, altså de mennesker, du jager? Hvordan vil du betegne dem?
Jamen, de er dybt professionelle. De er grådige og fuldstændig kyniske, og de er helt ligeglade med, hvordan de får fat i pengene, og de har fundet ud af, at det her marked her er high profit og low risk. Der er simpelthen, altså det er som at stjæle slik fra børn, fordi de har allieret sig med gode hackere, som får nogle penge, og så sørger de for at hive alle pengene ud af store scams. Det kan være din bankforretning, men for eksempel EU mister 106 milliarder euro om året på momssvindel. 60% mener vi, at kan du direkte linke til organiseret kriminalitet, og alt er lavet fra en computer. Det her, det er jo fast arbejde simpelthen, ikke? Så derfor er det virkelig dygtige kriminelle.
Hvordan får man fat i sådan nogle? Det må kræve folk, der sidder dag og nat og ruder efter dem.
Ja, det er dels folk, der sidder dag og nat, og dels et meget, meget bedre internationalt samarbejde. Vi bliver også nødt til at være hurtigere til at udveksle, hvad kan man sige, indicier og beviser. Det vil sige, at vi skal også have vores anklagemyndighed op i hastighed. Men jeg tror, alt det her skal vi nok overkomme. Problemet er mere, hvis de kriminelle flytter til stater, hvor der ikke er nogen rigtig infrastruktur, altså det vi kalder en failed state, så bliver det mere vanskeligt at obtaine, altså at få fat i de her i beviserne. Og det kan godt være en bekymring, men så må vi jo hjælpe de her lande til at bygge kapaciteter op.
Og det var altså Troels Ørting Jørgensen, som er chef for Europols cybercrime-afdeling her i EU. Det var en kort bemærkning, som sagt, han skulle nå fly. Men vi lover, at vi vender tilbage til ham og den her cybercrime-unit, fordi Troels Ørting kom faktisk til at mere eller mindre invitere aflytte til deres nye hovedkvarter. I hvert fald komme ned og besøge det ved lejlighed. Og det er bestemt noget, vi har tænkt os at tage op.
My name is Lily Coney. I'm Associate Director at the Electronic Privacy Information Center, also known as EPIC. EPIC is a public policy research center based in Washington, D.C. Part of my work at EPIC is looking at emerging technology issues and assessing their impact for privacy, civil liberties, or consumer protection, and developing the initial policy paper, which appears as a web page.
Lily Coney er direktør i den amerikanske borgerretsorganisation EPIC, Electronic Privacy Information Center. EPIC beskæftiger sig blandt andet med børns forhold i cyberspace, med overvågning generelt, og senest har de været kraftigt involveret i at få forbudt de her røntgenscannere i amerikanske lufthavne. Men hvad laver de så på kontinentet midt inde i EU?
How that now you are at the EU, at the center of all this EU stuff, how does that feel? Does it compare to anything in the United States?
Well, I think that what's very interesting in the digital information age that we're in, that what happens in one part of the world does impact the lives of people who live in the United States. We saw that happen a couple of times when the Data Protection Authority in Canada took action against Facebook and required that Facebook take steps in order to protect the privacy right of Canadian consumers. Facebook had to change their policy for all of North America. So it did help with the consumer rights of U.S. consumers because of the work of the Deep Data Protection Authority in Canada. So looking at what's going on in Europe, a complete retooling of the privacy protection legislation, one has started to move the U.S. in a number of ways. First with the president's report on consumer privacy that came out last spring, to the work being done by the Department of Commerce to try to come up with a multi-stakeholder process to address gaps in our law as it relates to consumer protection. Some of the work that's being done by the Federal Trade Commission because of complaints filed by EPIC against companies like Facebook and Google, the FTC has entered into consent decrees with companies and with both of those companies that will last for 20 years and have real consequences should they violate the privacy protection of their users. So in the long run, I think that privacy has always been an international issue where there's a lot of support for it. But now that we see more activity around strengthening privacy protection, it's definitely resonating in the United States as well.
EPIC og Europakommissionen har, hvad man godt kunne kalde for fælles fjender, Facebook og Google. EPIC er meget interesseret i at finde ud af, hvad vi har tænkt os at gøre her. Kampen om vores privatliv er nemlig ikke længere lokal. Den er global. Men set her fra EU er EPICs arbejde med amerikanske efterretningstjenester klart mere interessant for os. EPIC har nemlig flere gange taget fat i NSA, FBI og CIA og fået noget ud af det.
You're actually your organization. You're also taking on some of the major players that people in Europe are talking a lot about, namely the NSA and the CIA, actually holding them accountable for stuff they are doing. Could you describe what can an organization like yours do against, for example, the NSA?
Well, we have three very important laws. One is called the Federal Privacy Act. The other one is the Freedom of Information Act. And the third one is the Administrative Procedures Act. Now, the Federal Privacy Act means that any data collected on U.S. citizens, there are a set of conditions and rules that have to apply. That one, you can't create a system of records without putting notice in the Federal Register about it and giving more detail about why the information is being collected and how it's going to be used. And you have to do it within a certain time frame. You can't create the system and then afterwards tell people about it. There are protections within that act that have to be adhered to, but there are also opportunities for agencies to opt out of certain provisions of the Privacy Act, which can cause some difficulty for consumers. But basically, we pursue cases or pursue documents through Freedom of Information Act, which is another piece of legislation that says, that basically makes sure that citizens can know what their government is doing. So anyone can sit in a Freedom of Information Act request and get expect to get the reply from the agency or get the documents from the agency or get a reason why the agency isn't releasing the documents. Now, EPIC is unique in that if the government writes back and says, sorry, you know, we're not releasing the documents for whatever reason, if we disagree, we can go to an appeals process, which would be the next step. And if they don't acknowledge the release of the documents in the appeals process, then we're willing to sue them in federal court. And in launching a lawsuit, and the fact that we've worked in this area for so long, that our ability to go into a court and argue a case on why an agency should not be withholding documents, we've been very successful at doing that. We've sued agencies like the Department of Defense, the National Security Agency, the Central Intelligence Agency, the Department of Homeland Security, all successfully. We're willing to make that commitment, and with the support of people who contribute and some the foundations that support EPIC, we're able to make a multi-year commitment to pursuing documents to bring better understanding to the public about what agencies are doing.
Det handler om at skaffe åbenhed om, hvad efterretningstjenesterne egentlig laver, siger Lily Coney. EPIC bruger en metode, der vel bedst kan betegnes som dansk aktindsigt, til at få fat i papir om, hvad efterretningstjenesterne egentlig foretager sig. Men først kræver det, at man ved, at papirerne egentlig eksisterer. Uden den vished kan man nemlig ingen steder komme. Men hvor meget overvåger amerikanerne egentlig deres egne borgere?
Just how extensive is the surveillance currently going on against American citizens?
I think that's difficult to say because we're still trying to get documents to explain certain things, like Presidential Directive 54. Just knowing what that directive says will give us some idea of scope. It wouldn't give us details, it wouldn't give us targets, it wouldn't give us how many times it's used or how it's used, but it may give us some idea about what that directive speaks to. And so each piece of information that's not made available or not made transparent, it's hard to get an idea of how big something is. But the one thing we do work for at EPIC is transparency, is to make sure that that information that's not available to the public, that they should know about, is brought to the public's attention so that it can better evaluate the debate about whether this is something that's desired or not desired. We don't look for details on methods or means or targets or anything like that because that's not, wouldn't be relevant. It's really the constitutional legal authority to do something, or the policy or practice that's been put in place that would better inform us about what the activity is, and then whether and help bring that information to the public and let people have a debate about whether it's lawful or unlawful, or whether a law should be put in place to protect against it.
Befolkningen har mange forskellige mistanker om overvågning, men problemet er at bevise noget, siger altså Lily Coney. De mistanker har altid været der, nogle gange med god grund, for eksempel under 2. verdenskrig, hvor FBI faktisk aflyttede samtlige telegramlinjer og telefoner, for lige at sikre sig, at der ikke var spioner på linjen. Det er noget, man kan læse om nu, efter alle sagsakter er kommet frem. Hvad der sker i dag, kan man have sin mening om, men det er utroligt svært at bevise noget, siger altså Lily Coney. Men hvad så med NSA's globale overvågning, Echelon og alt det andet?
Routinely scanning and checking all emails going through the whole world and looking through it and putting it aside for further investigation. You know, the Echelon. And afterwards there's been this guy called William Binney, who's just used to work for them and has been a whistleblower about it. He's been listened widely to in Europe. Is there anything about this, or is this just crazy paranoia?
Actually, Bill Binney did come and speak with the Privacy Coalition about the activity he was aware of at the time he was at the National Security Agency. There are, I mean, whether, as far as what we would be looking at, having documents that say, yes, the NSA has been engaging in this global, worldwide review of email, we just don't have anything like that. I think that more of what we know comes from whistleblowers, people who are in agencies that come out and talk about what's going on. And what we are able to get from newspaper accounts, when the New York Times or the Washington Post or the LA Times or a major publication writes a story, an in-depth story about a particular government program, it gives some idea about something that may be out there that otherwise we wouldn't know about, and we will pursue those records.
Efter 9/11 fik USA en hel række nye institutioner, Homeland Security og US Cyber Command for eksempel. De er alle sammen ret lukkede og svære at få i tale, og det har skabt en helt ny situation for bevægelser som EPIC, der tit er nødt til at tage udgangspunkt i ting, der har stået i pressen, før de kan begynde at kræve at få nogle svar.
We did not have a Department of Homeland Security before September 11th. We did not have an Office of Director of National Intelligence. We didn't have a U.S. Cyber Command. We didn't have fusion centers. The list goes. We didn't have information sharing environment. I mean, it just goes on and on and on. How many ways things actually changed. That's why we've been focusing so hard on these issues, because there are things we know, but we're pretty sure there are a lot we don't know. And so the more information we can make available, the clearer the picture is of what happened after 9/11 happened, what kind of programs were created, what their intent was, how effective were they, should they still be in place.
Men et af de områder, hvor det var nemt for dem at gå i gang, var hos de amerikanske lufthavnsmyndigheder, TSA, der for et par år siden indførte røntgenscannere i samtlige lufthavne. Navnet på producenten stod ved siden af maskinerne, og det varede ikke længe før EPIC kunne vise billeder af, hvor meget man kunne se af sådan en røntgenfotograferet passager. Og det gav resultater. Protesterne kom i gang, og nu er maskinerne fjernet.
You could see them. We knew what they were. We were able to check the technology on the website of the companies that produced it. Their names were on the side of the machines. We learned a great deal about their claims, and then we learned a great deal about the state of the technology and the types of technology being used and the consequences that it could have on travelers. It was just too many factors to ignore, including health risks. Potential health risks that we needed to we had an obligation not to ignore that issue, because there are lots of issues all the time. Is this so egregious? Does this show go against everything that is a part of the American experience and the Constitution, the laws that are already on the books? Even looking at cases, we may look at a set of circumstances and say, well, the court got that wrong. You know, we're going to submit a brief on this, or we're going to pursue doing work on this. We may look at what an agency has done in the past. We're not going to say, well, we're not going to pursue it because the agency said this 3 or 4 years ago. Because if there's a circumstance that we think is very important, we will pursue that pursue new activity around it, a particular issue with an agency, and work to get a different result.
Men hvad synes hun egentlig om logningsbekendtgørelsen, der hænger over hele Europa? Er det en god idé? Vil amerikanere finde sig i det?
All over Europe, we got a data retention law, which actually means that If you call somebody or get called from somebody, the telephone companies needs to log it, and they also need to log who you're receiving SMSs from and who you're sending SMSs to and which websites you are entering and who you are emailing and who you are receiving emails from.
Oh, right,
from.
The online.
That is Data Retention Act. I think it's still on full all over Europe. If the United States were to do something like that to their own citizens, what would EPIC do?
Well, there were efforts based on the Child Online Privacy Protection Act, and under the there was a law dealing with children online, the safety of children online. And there was a request that went out asking for the search algorithms, the search engine, search request, that's what it was, search request, and IP address of users. And Google, of all companies, resisted the request for the data and went to court to fight the Justice Department's request. If they hadn't done that, we probably likely would not have known about that particular program. And we're seeing less and less of companies doing that. We see more and more collaboration between companies and government agencies. And that's part of what the panel I was on talked about, that there's a blurring of the lines. And because there's sort of an agreement, the private sector wants the data, the government wants the data, they don't want it for the same purpose, but they can agree that they want the information. So that agreement is complicating things. So the tension between the corporate side or the business side and government isn't there, because business tended to not want government to tell it what to do. So anytime government tried to do that, then you would get tension and more than likely would end up being litigated at some level. And that way we would know what was going on. Now, it's not that there isn't a history of companies engaging in participating in surveillance, because it is a history of that happening. But that history was considered to be ancient history until post 9/11. And then it became a imperative that companies try to, and it wasn't immediate that companies, I mean, the telecommunication companies were easier to approach because there was a history of working with law enforcement for surveillance or for due process, and even beyond that for during times of war or something like that with surveillance. And then, of course, existing laws about wiretap meant that there was ongoing relationships and FISA ongoing relationships. But post 9/11, there was a recognition that online services that were collected email or text messages or instant messages or even video or photos or other types of information were also sources of information. And the attempt to try to get them to come in and share data began. And initially there was some resistance, but with Google going to the NSA seeking assistance with after what has been called the China hack or something like that, because it was beyond their ability to deal with, they went to the NSA for assistance. And it was reported in all the papers. It's really one of those times when, okay, this should be easy. So we did a FOIA to the NSA asking for the letter from Google asking the NSA for assistance. And first there's something called GLOMAR, which means basically like, we cannot confirm or deny the existence of. And so we sued them and said, well, wait a minute, it's been confirmed in all these newspapers that you have this communication and we're just asking to see it. Unfortunately, the judge agreed with the NSA and said, nah, you don't need to see it, not really. So it was just one of those things where you think, okay, rationally, we should be able to get this letter because it's been in all the papers. We know this letter exists. We know they got it. But they were able to effectively argue that they didn't want to acknowledge the letter and they don't want to provide the letter, and so the letter doesn't exist, whatever. It's just one of those, you know. So we don't win everything, but we are pretty successful on most things that we pursue.
But in concerning the data retention that people are doing here in Europe.
Oh, data retention. Now, some companies voluntarily retain data, like Google said for 18 months it would retain data. Other companies are followed suit and using the same kind of rule of thumb. And they're retaining it in case law enforcement wants to come with the warrant. At least that's was the argument at the what the explanation was at the time, that they would retain the data just in case there was an investigation and that they needed to have access to the information. Since then, these same companies have entered into memorandums of understanding with the Government Services Administration to provide social networking services to federal government agencies. So the relationship is now changing from the government and us to government as clients. And how is that changing some of the responses that would have happened 4 or 5 years ago versus the responses that would occur today if the government agency is now a client?
So what is happening now is that the government might ask Facebook instead of say, we need data. So.
No, the government agencies actually have Facebook pages, and they actually have Twitter accounts, and they actually have some government, local government, state government agencies are switching their email to Gmail accounts. So now, instead of it being, oh, just some government agency bugging us about wanting access to something, it's now a major, potentially a major client who wants to get access to something. How do you respond to that, you know?
Nicer.
Yeah, right, you know. So that's why another reason why you want to have transparency in these relationships, because you don't know what's going on, and there's so much data, and if the company feels pressured or compelled because of a business relationship to disclose information, consumers should know that. And when they know that, then they can respond to that, and it may be the source of new legislation to better define what those roles should be and when it's appropriate to share the registration information and the activity of a user versus anytime you want to ask, potentially, could you get it? You know, so that's basically it.
Men hvad med det helt klassiske argument, hvis du ikke har noget at skjule, har du ikke noget at frygte fra staten?
One of the major arguments for surveillance and for checking up on citizens all the time you can do it is that if you don't have anything to hide, then you don't have any problems.
That's a false argument. It's the ultimate bad truth table. You know, like you get this. If this is true, then this must be true. No, you know, this might be true and that might be true. But believe me, that statement is false. It's so funny, if you start asking people answers to personal questions, it won't take long for them to tell you it's none of your business. And that's the thing that a lot of people don't understand, is that we're not talking about, they're only looking for people who definitely committed a crime. That's a due process way of thinking, that there has to be probable cause, and then there's due process, and then there's conviction, and then there's sentencing, and then there's jail time or restitution of some type. The world we're struggling not to enter will treat everyone as if they're criminal or suspected of something, and that you're always suspected of something until you actually transition from being a suspect to being treated as being guilty of something. And it's a reorientation of society that you're innocent until proven guilty is going by the wayside very quickly. So when people rationalize they have no problem with surveillance by saying they hadn't done anything wrong, they miss the whole fundamental purpose of democracy, living in a democracy, is that you don't have to be subjected to surveillance ever because the government decides you are worthy of that kind of attention. That it is all based on a triggering event or something that would lead to getting a court order to get a wiretap or a tracking device in order to follow somebody around. And it's not forever and ever, but it's enough time to determine whether someone is, in fact, engaged in some unlawful activity. And that's been the big struggle.
Du
lytter til aflyttet på Radio 477. Det var altså Lily Coney fra Epic, der fortalte her, og i næste uge kan du høre meget mere fra den her konference i Belgien. Du kan blandt andet høre noget mere om, hvorfor det her big data betyder noget også for dig, og ikke mindst, hvad det betyder, når jeg taler med chefen for SAS. Og nej, det er ikke det her fine flyselskab, som vi alle sammen kender. Det er heller ikke de her engelske elitesoldater. Det er som end en amerikansk koncern, der blandt andet sørger for, at din bankkonto bliver ved med at være sikker ved at sammenligne din normale opførsel med det unormale. Men det må du altså vente med til næste uge. Du har været en tur i aflyttet på Radio 24/7. Denne gang optaget, klippet og indtalt i Belgien, Bruxelles. EU er mig, Anders Kjærulf, og bagefter sendt afsted over internettet gennem tusindvis af blinkende små filtre, krydsende fra et direktiv til et andet, tværs gennem noget, der engang var grænser, men nu bliver kaldt handelshindringer, og direkte frem til dig, Jeb, dig der, der sidder ude ved en højtaler eller med en hovedtelefon i øret, mens du drømmer om frit at besidde sandheden i en sjæl og et legeme, men det bliver ikke lige nu, men måske om lidt, for nu er der nyheder på Radio 24/7.
Radio 24/7. Men det skal ikke være nogen hemmelighed, at det her program Løsgængeren, det er jo et politisk idéværksted, hvor vi prøver at komme med nogle politiske idéer, som vi håber på at kunne få gennemført. Og planen er i løbet af det første år, at hvis vi nu kunne få gennemført et lovforslag i virkeligheden, så ville vi ligesom have sejret.
Løsgængeren. Politisk idéværksted med Søren Fagli. Hver mandag kl. 10 her på Radio 24/7.
Radio 24/7.